Good evening, everybody, at home and in person. Okay, so our topic for tonight will be early Christian anti-Semitism, and we're going to review this book, The Teaching of Contempt, Christian Roots of Anti-Semitism by Jules Isaac. It's a little thin volume. You can get it on Amazon for $5. I suggest it's a good read. Over the last 6 weeks, we've covered the pre-Christian era, pagan anti-Semitism. And the big question was whether or not that earlier disdain for Jews and Judaism remained relevant as the centuries went on and paganism was dead and Christianity had replaced it as the dominant religious form. Or was that irrelevant and now Christianity with its new doctrines would be the reason why anti-Semitism becomes so entrenched in Western society? That was the major intellectual question. And during the Nazi period, there were Christian writers alarmed by what they saw in Christendom, that there could be such vicious Jew hatred, bordering on murderous, because we're still in the 30s and the Shoah had not yet happened, and wondering, how did we get here? And so next week, and maybe a couple of weeks after that, we're going to focus on the conflict between the church and the synagogue by James Parks. James Parks was an English clergyman who wrote this book in the 1930s to try to understand the Christian origins of anti-Semitism, rejecting the idea that the pagan origins mattered. He said it's all about the theology of the church and blames his own religion for such vicious Jew hatred. After the Shoah, this concept was taken up by many, many others, including Jules Isaac, who writes this book and a few other books. Isaac was a Frenchman, a French Jew, an assimilated French Jew. And when I say assimilated, I mean very patriotically French. His father was an army officer, his grandfather fought in the French army, and he was a great historian of French history. In the 1890s, he was a young man when Albert Dreyfus was convicted of treason. And when Dreyfus was rehabilitated, Jules Isaac was under the impression that France had purged from itself, from the body politic, the worst excesses of anti-Semitism. And we'd be okay as a society. You know, we overcame that. They rehabilitated Dreyfus. He was wrong. But yet, Judaism and Jewish identity was not a focus of his existence. He was a secular scholar of secular general history. But his Jewish identity caught up with him. And during the war years, his wife, his daughter, and his son-in-law were killed at Auschwitz. French Jews shipped off to Poland, killed at Auschwitz. His younger son survived, and he survived. But because of that traumatic experience, he turned to Jewish history and the history of anti-Semitism as the focus of his intellectual activities for the last 20 years of his life. And we'll see at the end of tonight's session, he was not only a writer of books or a pontificator, he also met the pontiff, in fact, multiple pontiffs. So he met Pius XII in 1949, and he met John XXIII in 1961, and was really instrumental in having theologians at high levels among the Jews and the Christians getting together to discuss serious issues and to try to put some of the worst aspects of Christian theological anti-Semitism behind the church, for them to disavow it. And that laid the groundwork for a Second Vatican Council, although he died in 1963 and did not live to see the day when it was ratified in 1965. Okay, so in his own words, quote, "If only by grievous and ever-worsening persecution, the Jewish question forced itself upon my mind and Jewish solidarity upon my heart and conscience. I was part of this hated, slandered, scorned Israel. Facing the persecutors, I fully accepted being part of it. I also had to take on a new struggle to deal with the unfair complaints they heaped upon us." So here he was not much of a Jew, but yet the Jew hatred made him into more of a Jew. And now he wants to investigate it. How did we get to this point from 2000 years ago? How did we get to this point? Okay. So The Teaching of Contempt is his last major work, in which he identifies three beliefs held by many, many Christians that in his view are not essential to Christianity. They are accretions to Christianity that have cropped up and become very, very, very popular. And people might think within the church that is an essential element of their belief, but he says, no, it's not. and it can be eliminated and undone. And these are beliefs that hold Jews in contempt. We'll go through them one at a time. So he starts off by saying, all authorities agree that a true Christian cannot be an anti-Semite. And he cites Catholic theologians, Protestant theologians. Throughout the book, he focuses primarily on the Catholic because he's from France, but he also always throws in a couple of Protestant ones as well. He says, all agree that to be an anti-Semite is unchristian. And yet, consciously or subconsciously, anti-Semitism is profoundly rooted in Christianity. So it's against the religion, but it's a dominant aspect of the religion. Okay? Even after Auschwitz, he says, it is alive in Christendom. That theological anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism did not die with World War II. It remained vibrant even after the war, and that's why he has to work so hard to try to undo it. Now, he says it will be objected that anti-Semitism has always existed, but this argument has no solid historical foundation. So what he's going to do here is say, yeah, they'll tell you that in Alexandria 2,100 years ago, the pagans and the Greeks hated the Jews too. So it's not really the fault of the church. The Jews were always hated because they were always terrible. And it's the Jews' fault. So don't blame the church. And he says people will make this claim, not because they really care about history or they really even know all that much about what happened in Egypt 2,100 years ago. They say it just to absolve Christianity of any wrongdoing. It's not a good faith argument. And as though Christianity bore no responsibility for its own attitude by claiming that the Jews are at fault for their own persecution and that their persistent non-assimilation is really is the cause of this problem. But he says, in the truth, the old pagan anti-Semitism was localized. The notion of universal anti-Semitism is as false as eternal anti-Semitism. It's simply not true, he argues, that always and everywhere did they hate the Jews. It was specific places, specific times. It wasn't universal, and it doesn't have to be eternal. Many Jews would argue, like we said last week, Esav son of Yaakov, halachai, it is eternal. It can't be undone. It can't be uprooted. He, a bit of a secularist, would say, no, no, why should we assume the worst about humanity? Good things could happen. It could be eliminated from the world. Then, don't confuse religious intransigence with cultural non-assimilation. The idea here is this. Jews want to preserve their religious identity, and they did under very adverse circumstances, hostile environment over many, many years. And that's a good thing. Don't confuse that with non-assimilation, because in fact, the Jews do assimilate in certain places. In plenty of areas, the Jews had a community and it ceased to exist because of eventual cultural assimilation. But he makes the point that you, the Christian reader of my book, would not have wanted the demise of Judaism, because if the demise of Judaism had happened early on in the history of our Jewish faith, there would be no Christianity and no Islam. If the Jews had given in to pagan influence 2,200 years ago, 2,300 years ago, or 2,100 years ago, in whether Eretz Yisrael or Egypt or any part of the Hellenistic world, there'd be no Christianity today. And you Christians wouldn't want that development. It would be unfathomable to you. So therefore, don't fault the Jew for preserving their religious heritage. Besides, he said, there's plenty of assimilation, plenty of acculturation. Look to the number of Jewish Nobel Prize winners. He actually uses that line. You know, Jews get very uncomfortable when someone makes that comment. Look to all the Jewish Nobel Prize winners. But he, in 1962, says it outright. But he makes a point that if the Jews were so insular, focusing only on their religion and on their own closed internal culture, then there would be no Nobel Prize winners. It's the product of involvement in the wider society. So you can't claim that your hatred for us is because we have not participated. We have, and we've done so very well. Moreover, so Jews went to Babylonia in 586 BC and did very well there. Jews went to China, and there was no anti-Semitism in China, and they blended into the point of being lost completely. We'd have to ask my friend, Rabbi Marvin Toker, about the history of how the Jews blended into China and disappeared. He'll tell you the whole story. But for the history of anti-Semitism, the Jews of China are very important, precisely because you don't find Jew hatred. Why not? If it's supposed to be everywhere and anywhere, then you would have found it there too.
Culturally isolated.
Okay, so being isolated geographically, thousands of miles from the main center of Jewish action, didn't prevent Jews from being despised in the Iberian Peninsula or in Gaul or in the Rhineland or even in early England. In Christendom, even if you were pretty far away geographically, there was still a lot of hatred. But in the East, there wasn't, which tells you what, as far as Isaac's point is concerned, that James Parks and the others, it's specific to Christianity that there's going to be a lot of Jew hatred. In other parts of the world, it won't exist.
I don't understand how he could say that it is not, the anti-Semitism is not part and parcel of the Christian church. I can't give you the quotations, but if you take a look at the New Testament.
So Norman is asking, if those at home, how can you separate out what is a core Christianity that is being claimed here does not support anti-Semitism versus the lived religion, which was highly anti-Semitic? And the answer is, in many ways, what this author does is a bluff. A lot of it can't really be justified, making that kind of a dichotomy. But he does it in deference to the fact that there are very pious and believing Christians who hold esteemed positions in the church in the late 40s, 50s, and early 60s, and he wants to engage them in dialogue and doesn't want to be seen as antagonistic to their faith, in its totality. He would like to have a pleasant discussion among two sides that respect the integrity of each other's religion. So as a point of departure, he has to offer at least a modicum of respect. Maybe he really did believe it. And I get to the impression that to an extent he did. But he overplays it for the purpose of having dialogue. Okay, now, pagan pre-Christian anti-Semitism was centered at Alexandria. As far as Jules Isaac is concerned, that was a very vulgar sort of anti-Semitism. Vulgar in that it was not based upon deep theological thought. It was based upon vicious, canards, like the Jews fatten a Greek and slaughter him as a sacrifice to the god, or they worship the donkey in their temple. All sorts of stupidity and grotesque stupidity is what's undergirding pagan anti-Semitism, insofar as it's not financially based and economically based, as we know much of it was. But he also says that, and I reviewed a couple of weeks ago, pagan governmental anti-Semitism was inconsistent. For most of the time, the government was good to the Jews and trusted the Jews, and only in rare instances did the government turn hostile. Usually, Jews were treated reasonably well. Christian anti-Semitism, which is essentially theological, has been more pernicious and persistent because it has continued up to our own time. Meaning he's saying, this is what we deal with now. We're not dealing with what they believed a long time ago in the Hellenistic world. We're dealing with the here and now, where our interlocutor is a Christian. Christianity began as an outgrowth of Judaism, but when it abandoned the law, clashes were inevitable. How could the church proselytize while Jews the world over rejected these new teachings? Only by destroying the prestige of their adversary, the synagogue, would they be able to succeed. So he's offering a suggestion why it is that the early church had to besmirch the synagogue. Very simply, because they're looking to the same pagan crowd to win them over as adherents to a faith. And if Christianity is known to be an outgrowth of Judaism, but the Jews themselves say this is not kosher, this is wrong, this is in theological error, then how does the church expect the pagan, who can't tell what one thing from the other, how are you going to expect them to convert to your group if the original group says this is a false breakaway? And the answer is, you deny the legitimacy of the original group. You besmirch them and say that they're guilty of all sorts of sins. Well, the teaching of contempt for Jews and Judaism. Theological myths that overstep the bounds of historical and scriptural accuracy. Basically, you create myths about the adversary, the other, that don't stand up to historical scrutiny, but you can get away with it because nobody knows the history or nobody cares. That's an important point. Do we really care about the facts of the past when we discuss matters of religion? Ostensibly, we're supposed to, but every religion engages in game playing, embellishment, telling of stories that didn't really happen. And the church is going to do that about the Jews and about Jewish involvement in what? The killing of Jesus and a few other things as well. So since nobody was around to see it, you can spin a good yarn however you like. But centuries and centuries later, after a lot of people have died in the name of such religious hatred, it might be just time to look back at the history and say, well, maybe the theology took things a little too far. So the goal that Jules Isaac is setting for himself is not to undermine Christianity, really to rid the church of unnecessary accretions, deep-seated prejudices, odious habits of mind, heart, and tongue. Okay, the first teaching. Let's get to it. The dispersion of the Jews is providential punishment for the crucifixion, meaning the galut. Why do the Jews get kicked out of their land? What do we say in Musaf? Bipnei chataenu galinu me'artzenu. What chait are we referring to? Well, gilui arayos, shpichas damim, avodah zarah, bittul talmud Torah, lashon hara, gezel, you name it. There's a whole long roster of things we could say al chait for. But if the Christians were making a perush on our Musaf, what would they say? What was the chait? Because we killed Jesus, we crucified him. Okay, so the dispersion is because of that sin. Now, what the author of this work wants to get across, and I spent a whole year with you guys doing in 2014, 2015, if you remember that far back, it's been a long time, when we spent a year on After the Churban. The tapes are on YU Torah. So After the Churban was a course that we had here from the year 70 up until the Islamic conquest in the year 638. And it was something of a dry course, in my view, because it wasn't about great religious events. It was more petty politics and the decline of Jewish community of Eretz Yisrael. But if there was one thing I tried to get across was there was a Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael. And that the notion of Galut Edom, the exile imposed upon Israel by Edom, by Rome, is a myth. It never happened. We tell it to the internal Jewish constituency for whatever reason, and I have to research this further as to when the origin of the term Galut Edom or Galut Romi, but it never happened. The church believed it, but the church believed it happened because we killed Jesus. So history has a right to ask theology not to misconstrue the data. It is true that theology goes beyond history, but only provided that the theology respect history as a point of departure. Christian theology commonly teaches that the dispersion of Israel dated to 70 CE and is divine punishment for the crucifixion. By the 4th century, all the church fathers were saying. They claimed that Jesus predicted the temple would be destroyed and Israel be scattered. Some saw this as definitive proof of the divinity of Christianity at the expense of Judaism. This is a big deal. The fact that the temple was destroyed and Jews were around the world and the Commonwealth of Judea as a Jewish commonwealth was gone was seen by many Christian theologians and commoners as the best of all proof that God hates them and we're the real Israel now. Supersessionism as proved by political facts on the ground. That's the idea. Well, the assertion has been so categorically made so categorically and repeated so many times over the centuries that it passed from Christian works, religious works, even into standard works of history. If you were to read academic works of classical era history written in the 1800s from the German universities or in the early 1900s from the British universities or even up to World War II, it will often be said by a university professor, not a pastor, not a priest, none of that, that Judea was destroyed, because the Jews, you know, crucified Jesus, and then there was no longer a Jewish presence in Eretz Yisrael, they were exiled to the four corners of the earth. Arba kanfota aretz. Arba kanfota aretz. Well, what's the real truth? What really happened? The historical reality is that the dispersion began more than 500 years before the Christian era. We could even date it back even further. Hebrew migrants to Damascus in the 9th century BCE left during the reign of Ahab, the evil king Ahab, all right, and his wife Jezebel. Then there were migrants to Egypt in the 8th century BCE. Then the destruction of the northern kingdom by Ashur in the year 722 led to the loss of the 10 tribes of Israel. Aseret HaShvatim, the 10 lost tribes. So where are they going? I don't know where they are now, but they went somewhere. They went out of the country to points east and north. Then the Babylonian captivity of 586. Very few Jews went back to the promised land in the days of Cyrus. Hatzarat Koresh, you can go back and build your temple and rebuild your commonwealth. Yeah, but how many actually did? 43,000, something like that, the Bible says. Very, very few. So most of the Jews are living where? Not in the borders of Eretz Yisrael, somewhere else. Also, there were migrations of Jews to Arabia and to the islands of the Eastern Mediterranean. So 2,500 years ago, there was already a large and widespread Jewish diaspora. The dispersion of Israel saw a great expansion after the conquest of Alexander and the Hellenization of the Orient in the 4th through 2nd centuries BCE. Not through conniving, as the Christian historians would have you believe, but through merit, loyalty, and capability, Jews were trusted throughout the Hellenistic world to be colonists, mercenary soldiers like we saw at Elephantine, administrators, etc. So Jews were heavily involved in governmental affairs all around the known Hellenistic world and outside of Eretz Yisrael. With the Roman conquest and the founding of the Roman Empire, the diaspora expanded to include the whole Mediterranean world. As a result of the Pax Romana, the great peace of the world, if you want to call it that, as a result of the expansion of the Roman Empire, Jews moved as far as Gaul, meaning France, Italy, the Rhineland, the Iberian Peninsula, and the Maghreb, northern Africa. Jews were sent to slave markets all over Europe after Pompey conquered Judea in 63 BCE and sacked the temple and went into the Kodesh Kedoshim, etc. So those Jews typically bought their freedom, or they were assisted in buying their freedom by fellow Jews shortly thereafter. So there were Jews everywhere. There were Jews all over the world, all over the known world. And this is before the Churban. Instead of becoming pagans, the Jews in far-flung provinces missionized to the Gentiles. So let's talk numbers. There were approximately 7 million Jews in the days of Jesus, out of an empire of 60 million people. And of that, 2 million lived in Eretz Yisrael, which means 5 million lived elsewhere. So the most Jews didn't live in Israel. And there was another 1 million Jews outside the Roman Empire in the Parthian lands of Persia and further east. So there were a lot of Jews. 20% of the population in the Eastern Roman Empire was Jewish. And the vast bulk of them did not live in Eretz Yisrael. So if the vast bulk of Jews didn't live in Israel in the days of Jesus, is it fair to say that the Galut was a product of his crucifixion? How can you say that at all? It doesn't jive with history. It's simply incorrect. So, moreover, we never find in the New Testament that Jesus predicted that Judea would be Judenrein. The idea that all the Jews are going to have to leave their native land, it never says that. Later, Christian scholars will try to claim that he did say it and that it happened, and therefore his predictions came true, and it's a great prophecy. But that's a Baba Maisa. He never said it, and it never happened. So what actually happened in the year 70 relative to the Jewish population and the notion of the diaspora? So Josephus claims that 1.1 million Jews died in the Great Revolt. That's a tremendous number, tremendous number. And that 97,000 Jews were sent on slave ships across the Mediterranean to the ports of the Italian peninsula. But a massacre is not the same thing as a dispersion. Judaism survived and thrived in Eretz Yisrael after the year 70. There was a major war, 132 to 135, the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. And had it really been the case that the Jews were exiled, such a war would have been an impossibility. How could it be that a non-existent people held, fended off the Roman imperial army for 3 years? That couldn't have happened. It must be that demographically there was still a significant base of Jews in their ethnic homeland, and they were willing to fight for it and fight to the bitter end. Okay, but even the bitter end wasn't the end, because there were still Jews in Eretz Yisrael.
What you're saying is there were 800,000 Jews. At one point, 2 million minus...
So it went down considerably, and it's going to go down even further till eventually they no longer are the ethnic majority in the country. When exactly that happens, we can't know for sure, but the guesstimate is it's around the year 300. Jews cease to be the majority in their own country. So some scholars, Christian scholars, will keep the idea that Jews went into the Galut as punishment for the crucifixion, but they will acknowledge that that didn't happen 4 decades after Jesus' death in the year 70, but rather they'll postpone this supposed event, to the year 135, after the Bar Kokhba War. Yet that's also wrong, because Jews still flourished spiritually and intellectually, with academies at Yavne, then Usha, then Tzipori, Tveria, Shfaram, even Caesarea, Caesarea. There was intellectual, spiritual life for the next couple of hundred years. There's the composition of the Mishnah around the year 200. There's the composition of the Yerushalmi around the year 350 to 400. These things couldn't have happened if the Galut had been absolute and there were no Jews remaining. Moreover, the Romans allowed the establishment of the Patriarchate as an ethnarch of the Jews. Now, the Patriarchate is the Beit Hanasi, the Beit Gamliel. There's a question about when the House of the Patriarch was really established. I mean, according to the Jewish version in Pirkei Avos, it's been around since the days of the Zugot. But that's a little bit of an exaggeration. Even to say it was around from the days of Gamliel the Elder, maybe a little bit of an exaggeration. But certainly, in the days of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, it was a recognized position and continued to be till the year 425, with the days of Gamliel the Sixth. So don't tell me that there were no Jews in Israel, or that they were dead as a national body. No, they weren't. They were not politically in control. Yes, the Roman administration was in charge, but they still existed. Okay. So no definitive dispersion ever happened, but a progressive impoverishment of Eretz Yisrael Jewry did occur. Such is the historical reality. And as far as Jules Isaac is concerned, this should be obvious to everyone, to theologians and historians alike. And there never should have been this notion of Galut Adom. And certainly not Galut Adom as a punishment for killing Jesus. Moreover, he notes that there was a rebellion in the year 350. Then there was another rebellion with the Samaritans against Justinian in the 6th century. And lastly, in the year 614, the Jews fought with the Persians against the Byzantines. And we discussed that 5-6 years ago, how the Jews were given control over Jerusalem very briefly between 614 and 617, and they massacred the Christians, although we don't talk about that. But eventually, the Persians lost. The Byzantines took back over the country and controlled it for the next 20 years, were vicious against the Jews, and then they lost themselves to the Muslim invaders, the Muslim hordes, in 638. Okay, so that's the first of the three pillars of the teaching of contempt. The idea that there was a dispersion and was a punishment for the sin of the crucifixion. Now let's go to the second pillar of the teaching of contempt. And that is the degenerate state of Judaism at the time of Jesus. It's a theological contention which was invented, reinforced, and propagated for hundreds of years, that at the time of the first half of the first century CE, the religion of Israel was mere legalism without a soul. Who said the same sort of thing in the 1760s?
Mendelssohn.
Not Mendelssohn, go the other religious direction. The Baal Shem Tov, or the early Hasidism, criticizing conventional Ashkenazic religion, which becomes Misnagdism, that it's legalism without a soul. It's not inspiring the masses. Okay? Well, the claim is that Jews are carnal beings who are blinded to the true meaning of their own scriptures. So here the church fathers would say, you, the Jews, gave us the Bible, but we read it better than you do. You can't read your own Bible. You're embarrassing yourselves. You don't know how to read your own Bible. The religious life of Israel was led astray by the Pharisees and on a road to decadence, said another church father. It was reduced to mere external formalism, that nothing remained of the great religion of Abraham, Moses, David, and the prophets, save for narrow ritualism. Well, tell me something. The criticism of Judaism as narrow ritualism will inevitably emerge from a group that does what? That gets rid of ritual. If you want to justify non-observance, what's the best way to do it?
Don't observe.
Well, in fact, you're not going to observe. But what are you going to say about people who do observe? That they have terrible religion. That it's narrow ritualism. In truth, the reform movement in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s in Germany and in the United States said the same thing. When Isaac Mayer Wise was attacked after the Trefa banquet in 1885, he said, oh, that's just stomach Judaism, kitchen Judaism. All right? You can always justify your own impiety by mocking the piety of those who are pious. And that's what is happening here, saying, well, Judaism was a terrible religion because it focused on the Dalet Amot Shel Halacha, the halachic minutia, and that the Pharisees and the scribes heaped further and further minutia, Tilei Tilim Shel Halachot, as we say, you know, Rabbi Akiva would expound upon the crowns and the letters, and you would find Tilim Shel Halachot, mounds of laws. If you don't like laws, then that's not a good thing, it's a bad thing. Okay, and you make fun of people for doing it. Well, the Pharisees and scribes had not the slightest concern for moral or spiritual purity. That's the accusation. There's a line in the Talmud that speaks to this issue. It's the story of the foot race. The foot race up the Mizbeach ramp.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what happens on the foot race? So if two Kohanim wanted to do the same avoda, they run to the top. And the end zone is the last few amos before you get to the top. Whoever gets to the end zone first, touchdown, they get the service. Okay? Well, what happened? On one occasion, pushed him off the side, broke the guy's leg. But on another occasion, stabbed him in the heart and killed him. And the Talmud says that the father of the boy who was stabbed says, don't worry, everyone. Don't worry. No. He's still twitching, which means he's not dead yet, which means that the knife is not tummy. So you could take the knife out and still use it for the avoda. Now, the Gemara says, well, what was going on here? Was it that the tumah was so important to them that it outweighed considerations of life and death, but they respected life and death? Or that tumah of the knife was respected in the ordinary way, but life and death meant nothing to them. In other words, their priorities were totally out of whack. Whatever it is, the priorities were out of whack. Comes along the great rabbi and says, who's going to bring the egla arufa? Now, when do you bring an egla arufa? When you have a dead body, lo no dam mihi kahu. You don't know who killed him. So what do el harim, you measure the distance from this city to the body, this city to the body, and the city that is closest, krovala halal, they do the decapitated heifer ritual, and the elders say, Yadin lo shkuat adam hazeh, we didn't shed this blood, they named no Ra'u, we didn't see who killed him, and kaper lamcha, God, please provide expiation for your people. Well, is there really an egla rufa brought this case? They saw who killed the guy. Moreover, it's done in the temple, and there's no egla rufa for the temple. So it was just a show. It was to get people to cry, bevechi, to appreciate the importance of one human life. So here you have the Talmud acknowledging that, yes, there may have been a problem of warped priorities among some Jews in that era, but that the rabbis themselves, or the proto-rabbis, the Pharisees, they had the priorities in the right order, and they understood that human life is of utmost sanctity, more so than petty issues of Tumah V'Tahara. So whatever Christian criticism of the rabbis and the scribes and the Pharisees and the sages, that they were just into petty legalism, our tradition says otherwise, that we were concerned for the bigger picture issues. Okay. Well, once again, historical reality belies the main arguments of this traditional Christian teaching in attesting to the vitality of religious life in Israel at this period. So what Isaac does is he identifies in the 200 years preceding the crucifixion, what were some of the spiritual accomplishments of the nation of Israel in its homeland to prove that this was not a soulless religion just focused on the minutiae of what appears in the Mishnah Berurah, Lahavdil, you know, from the 1905 version of retrojecting it back in time. It was more than just the Dalamot Shel Halacha. What else was there? There was religious writings. There was the Book of Daniel, the Book of Maccabees, the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs, the Book of Jubilees, the Book of Enoch, the Psalms of Solomon. Basically, all the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha, which are not in our Tanakh, but are, you know, in the external works, the Sfarim Chitzonim, but some of these works are in the Christian Bible, so they do respect it. These were written at this time. Jews were productive in the literary sense, and good material, spiritual material, that the Christians themselves deemed worthy of including in the Bible. Moreover, there was the evolution of the synagogue. The synagogue as an institution emerges at this time, outside the confines of the Temple Mount. Prayer in a building, or if it's not a building, as a regular communal aspect of public worship. And this prefigures the mosque and the church. So you Christians who love your church, well, where do you get it from? Because we had a synagogue. When did we develop the synagogue? Around this time. Moreover, the Jews adopted good new doctrines, like the resurrection of the dead and the last judgment. The Rambam wouldn't like that, because the Rambam would say all these doctrines are, you know, from Ramos Moshe Rabbeinu and onward. But all right, so the scholars will say that certain of the Jewish doctrines of the afterlife are later concepts that developed in Second Temple times. And these are good concepts. And the Christians accepted them also. So here is Jules Isaac saying, what are you telling me that Judaism was dead and unproductive spiritually? It was great at that time. Moreover, the notion of the dual Torah, the written Torah and the oral Torah, emerges right around this time. Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. Before that, you really don't have the concept of the separate Torah. You just have the explication of verses of the Bible. But the idea of a dual Torah emerges in the period of the Zugot, which is right around the time of Jesus' birth. So it's a great time for religion. Then he says, he spends two chapters on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Why does he spend so much time on the Dead Sea Scrolls? Because, well, first of all, they're discovered right around this post-World War II era, 1947 and 1952. So it's new, it's fresh, it's a hot item. But he says that the Dead Sea Scrolls give us insight into the Essenes. And the Essenes were one of the principal Jewish sects at the time of the turn of the Common Era. So we learn about the teacher of righteousness, the Moritz Tzedek. The Moritz Tzedek was possibly the Kohen Gadol after Yachim Yishtzorot in 158. Before Yonatan the Chashmonai, the Maccabees, become the high priests, it's possible the Moritz Tzedek was the high priest. But he runs away to Qumran, to the Dead Sea area, and rejects the temple. The temple is treif. It's been made corrupt and impure. So we'll live life as a monastic sect in the middle of nowhere with our own rules. Okay, the Moritz Tzedek, the teacher of righteousness, may have been killed, martyred for his cause, and he was revered after his life, and his followers anticipated his eventual return, Le'atid Lavo. What does this sound like? Jesus. Okay, so there's a lot of overlap here. Moreover, the suffering servant of Isaiah 53, which is applied by Christians to Jesus, was applied by the Essenes to the Moritz Tzedek. So there's a lot of overlap here, a lot of parallel, but there's also differences. The Essenes were very strict when it came to the law, whereas the church becomes antinomian, hostile to the law. But in any event, Judaism as a so-called religion of grace, a concept that the church espouses about itself, was already true in the Essenes 150 years before the turn of the Common Era.
So the Christians thought our God is a jealous and a vindictive God.
Yeah.
Other than the Christian God.
Right, which was a benevolent deity. Benevolent deity. That's true. Because if you look at the Old Testament, there's a lot of anger. Kael Kana. There's a lot of vengeance. But sometimes for good reason. You know?
No, but I'm saying that is a defense, or rather an antagonism against the Jews. That's saying our God is all
right.
Forgiving and your
God is not. Is the polar opposite. Now, the discoveries at Qumran not only revolutionized the history of pre-Christian Judaism, but likewise that of the origins of Christianity. Did Jesus have any connection to the Essenes? was he influenced by the teacher of righteousness? So likely John the Baptist wasn't, who was hanging out near the Jordan River and not too far from Qumran, was, if not an Essene himself, influenced by them, and he in turn influenced Yeshu. So for all the similarities, though, there are differences. The Essenes favored asceticism and Jesus did not. The founder of the Essenes was a learned priest versus the founder of Christianity, who was an ignorant, low-class artisan. So one was a select group of initiates, whereas the other was the people's preacher, a populist. Christianity then came from marginal Judaism, not from the Pharisee Hillel, which is often what is claimed, that Hillel was a forerunner, the golden rule, the Haftal Recha Kamocha, turn the other cheek, that sort of thing. Well, before we turn to the third pillar of the teaching of contempt, I want to read to you what Isaac pleaded when it comes to not disparaging one religion in order to elevate another. Remember, the goal of the church was to win over adherents. How do you do it? By making the other religion look terrible. So he says like this: to give a true picture of Judaism at the time of Christ, with its atmosphere of crisis and anticipation, taking note of deviations but also of the wealth of its religious life, without oversimplifying to the point of presenting it as an utterly decadent, to avoid the same distortion in speaking of later or contemporary Judaism, any attempt to exalt Christ or Christianity by way of a systematic disparagement of Judaism would be as unworthy as it would be inaccurate. For example, we will avoid comparing the Old Testament with the New as a law of fear as opposed to a law of love. Okay, so Norman, your issue of the jealous God versus benevolent deity. You know, we're not going to compare these things. It's not right. It's not nice. At the heart of the religion of Israel, there is boundless confidence in a God of infinite mercy. And its first commandment is to love God with all one's heart. If Christ brings the fullness of this revelation, he likewise insists just as much as the Old Testament did on divine commands and eternal punishments. As for the formalism with which Israel has already been reproached so often by her own prophets, is this not a temptation which threatens the practice of any religion? Meaning, every religion runs into the problem of formalism. You develop, you have your ways, your halachot, in whatever belief system you have, and then you follow it. And then someone can come along from the outside and say, you're just following your halachot. We could say it about Judaism. We could say it about the Catholic Church or the Eastern Orthodox Church or Islam or Hinduism. Every religion could be criticized the same way. So let us, in the good faith efforts of interreligious dialogue, not do that. Okay, let's go to the third pillar of contempt. The third pillar is the crime of deicide, that the Jews are collectively guilty of what? Of killing God. Okay? Now, this is a very serious issue because the notion of Christ killers is really an inflammatory statement that can rile up a crowd to murder. If you killed, we'll kill you. With no mercy. Lo tachos einecha. No idea has been more destructive and has had more deadly effect on the scattered Jewish minorities living in Christian countries than the pernicious view of them as a deicide people. Israel equals Cain, a murderous people, and they carry the mark on their foreheads, the mark of Cain. Now, the mark of Cain is stupid, because if you actually read the Torah, what does it really say? The mark of Cain was a good thing to save his life. But somehow in the Christian tradition, it became a sign like the scarlet letter, an A. You're guilty, 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 guilty. You're bad. Not a protective amulet of some kind. Okay. Well, in your fathers, you have killed Christ. That was a common refrain over the centuries, that in your fathers, because of your father's deeds, you also, meaning you who live now, have killed the same entity. So, Christian doctrine here requires that we make a careful distinction between the theological and the historical plane. The accusation of deicide issues from the dangerous confusion of the two. How can you kill God? It seems impossible. Moreover, if God wanted to take human form and sacrifice himself, how was it a crime? How can you blame the Jews for deicide when Jesus himself never claimed divinity? That's an important point. If we read the New Testament, at least the Synoptic Gospels, we're not going to find that Oso Haish is saying about himself that he's any more than an Ish, a man. So how can you criticize somebody for an action they might or may not have taken when the supposed crime doesn't get off the ground if that concept was yet to be articulated? Well, how can you blame all the Jews when only a small number in Eretz Yisrael even knew that Jesus existed? How can you blame subsequent generations who are yet to be born? All these are good and fair questions, but they're questions that our adversaries didn't want to have to answer. They just liked to level the accusation because it was fun and it was helpful. The crucifixion is an historical event, maybe, and cannot be understood without reference to its historical setting. The Romans were in control. So if he has any one point that he wants to get across is that the Romans control everything. They are the bosses. Pontius Pilate is the procurator. The Roman and not Jewish method of execution was crucifixion. They killed rebellious Jews that way. Inexplicably, the victims became transformed into executioners. So here a Roman killed a Jew, and now the Jews are guilty of killing God. That's the inexplicable nature of the whole thing. The Gospels are the only source of information on the crucifixion. And these are works of religious teaching and persuasion and are not concerned with historical accuracy. Would a Christian clergyman agree with that? If you walk into an Aguda shul and you say that the stories in Bereishis and Parshas Noach, Genesis chapters 1 through 11, are to be taken metaphorically, would they run you out of the shul?
No. They'll crucify.
Okay, so in a doctrinaire environment, whether our religion or their religion or any other religion, the idea that somebody's sacred scriptures are religious teaching but not to be taken for historical truth is inevitably going to upset somebody. However, it should be noted that in Christianity, at least in the 20th century, plenty of people who occupied significant positions within the hierarchy of their respective denominations did come to accept the idea that the Synoptic Gospels don't exactly tell the 100% historical truth, that they're written decades and decades after the events that purportedly happened, and they can't know all the details, and they fudge a little bit. They're intended to teach values within that religious tradition, not to be a moment-by-moment running a diary of what occurred. So to the extent that Caiaphas, the high priest, or the Sanhedrin, is emphasized in the New Testament, it was because the church was trying to curry favor with Rome at a time when these works were written. It's easier to blame the Jews decades after the event supposedly occurred. This is an important point. Rome doesn't like the church. We're talking now second half of the first century, early part of the second century. The church is seen as seditious. And so there's persecution of Christians. They throw the Christian to the lions. We're going to learn about that next week. So the church is trying to improve its relations with the governing body. How do you do that? By retelling your founding story in a way that basically absolves their guy who really killed your guy, and instead pin the blame on your former co-religionists, who are the original group of the covenant, and say, well, they rejected the Savior and they killed him. And as for Rome, they were sort of passive in the whole thing. That Pontius Pilate threw up his hand and said, you guys do whatever you want to do. You want to find him guilty? Good. He's guilty. We'll kill him. So there's a retelling of the story with an agenda of around the year 80, 90, 100 that is not Romanophile, but geared towards placating Rome and geared towards sticking it to the Jews. And that's why the text says what it says, even if it's illogical to think that Jews controlled the life and death destiny of somebody at a time when they probably didn't have capital punishment at their disposal. Okay, so these are the three pillars of the teaching of contempt, as explained by Jules Isaac. So now I want to read to you, in the time we have left, what happened after the war. After the war, in 1947, there was the Seelsburg Conference in Switzerland. It was convened as the International Emergency Conference on Anti-Semitism. Emergency Conference on Anti-Semitism. It sounds like the sort of thing like the ADL would do nowadays, like Emergency Conference on Anti-Semitism. But then it really was. A year and a half after the Shoah, 2 years after the Shoah, and there's a sense that people in Europe still hate the Jews with a passion. And the fact that 6 million died didn't change that. You know, in Kielce, after the war in Poland, what happened? They made a pogrom, right? Plenty of Jews were killed in the latter half of 45 and in 46 because they stumbled across the wrong property that they thought used to belong to them. Boom, you're dead. People still hate it. And yet, how could they after, you know, such inhumanity to man? So it was a conference of the International Council of Christians and Jews, and they put out a 10-point roster of talking points, agenda items. I'll read them to you. And it's relevant because Jules Isaac was instrumental in this list being prepared. Number one, remember that one God speaks to us all through the Old and New Testaments. Well, that's very nice if you're a Christian or a Jew. If you're a Muslim or you're a Shinto or a Buddhist or an animist, that's not going to be the case. But in Europe, okay, in Switzerland, when we're after the Shoah, Christians and Jews, fine, the Old and the New Testament. Number two, remember that Jesus was born of a Jewish mother, of the seed of David, and of the people of Israel, and that his everlasting love and forgiveness embraces his own people and the whole world. So, I mean, as a Jew, I'm a little reluctant to accept the fables about Jesus's Davidic ancestry. The Christians can believe that all they want. I'm a little hesitant to think that a guy from Nazareth really was from Beit Lechem. All right. But they wanted to write this. They wrote it.
The first page of the New Testament gives
the whole lineage. How accurate that is, who's to say? I wasn't there. But this idea that his love embraces his own people. Do you think a Jew-hating goy wants to hear it be said that the Jews are his own people, Jesus' own people? For the hillbilly anti-Semite, that's not going to be something they want to hear. And yet, they're saying it here. So it's a step forward. Number three, remember that the first principles, the first disciples, the apostles, and the first martyrs were Jews. Why is it necessary to say such an obvious point? Because there are people who are stupid and didn't know that. Never forget that there are a lot of very ignorant people out there who were oblivious to the fact that early Christianity was a Jewish sect. Number four, remember that the fundamental commandment of Christianity, to love God and one's neighbor, proclaimed already in the Old Testament and confirmed by Jesus, is binding upon both Christians and Jews in all human relations without exception. All right, so this is a love thy neighbor means even if he's not like you. It's a nice 21st century slogan they have in Israel. So already they're saying that in 1947, without exception. Even if they're different from you, human love has to apply. Number five, avoid distorting or misrepresenting biblical or post-biblical Judaism with the object of extolling Christianity. Bingo, that's Jules Isaac's main point, and point number two of the three pillars of contempt. Don't give a false depiction of what Judaism was or is to prop up your own faith. People do it all the time, but you shouldn't. Be honest in interfaith dialogue and be willing to say favorable things, nice things about the other guy, if it really is true. Don't disparage them in ways that aren't merited by the facts. Okay. Number six, avoid using the word Jews in the exclusive sense of the enemies of Jesus and the words, the enemies of Jesus, to designate the whole Jewish people. This is important. Jew was a dirty word. You know, in the 19th century, what did Jews like to call themselves? Hebrews, Israelites, members of the Mosaic faith, okay, Hebrew Union College, Temple Israel, all the terminology in America today among the non-Orthodox is a product of that time. Yeah, Jewish Center became from Kaplan, but before Kaplan was around and calling things Jewish Center, it was all Hebrew, Israel, this, because Jew was dirty. So what this is saying is, let's try not to make Jew a dirty word. Don't use it just in reference to the enemies of Jesus. Okay, then seven, avoid presenting the passion in such a way as to bring the odium of the killing of Jesus upon all Jews or upon Jews alone. It was only a section of the Jews in Jerusalem who demanded the death of Jesus. And the Christian message has always been that it was the sins of mankind, which were exemplified by those Jews, and the sins of which all men share that brought Christ to the cross. So what does this mean? That in their theology, Christ dies for the sins, for so-called our sins, not for the sins of the Jews in killing him, but for the sins of all humankind that he has to be like a kapara for. Now, fine, they can believe that if they want, but the point is, it's not dafka the sins of the Jews or the sins of the Jews who killed him. It's expanding the guilt to the rest of humanity. And we need that. We don't need to be the only fall guy, the only scapegoat. Better everybody should take on a certain burden in that regard. Okay? Then 8, avoid referring to the scriptural curses or the cry of the raging mob, his blood be upon us and our children, without remembering that this cry should not count against the infinitely more weighty words of Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. So here the New Testament has a line which is so ridiculous, okay? His blood be on us and on our children. Who would ever say such a thing? If you really hated the guy and you're glad he's dead, would you say Chatasi and my grandkids should suffer for eternity over it? No, it's a totally illogical line, but yet it was used against us for hundreds of years to justify our persecution. So what this council is saying, put that aside for the time being. Focus instead upon they know not what they do. Tinok Shanishba, that even if you think somebody bears an element of guilt, that they're not of your faith group, they're of a despised faith group, don't despise them so much. Tinok Shanishba. They don't know. Beshogig. It's not amazing. It's an interesting idea. I mean, this is written from a very Christian perspective, but I happen to like this idea of Beshogig Lob amazing. Then, 9, avoid promoting the superstitious notion that the Jewish people are reprobate, accursed, reserved for a destiny of suffering. Well, that's already Augustinian. We're going to get to Augustine of Hippo, who says that the Jews have to survive as witnesses to the truths of Christianity. They live, but they live as a suffering and beleaguered people. And that was said in the late 4th century. Well, we live in the 21st, so it means for a good 1600 years, the Christian doctrine, or the, I wouldn't say doctrine, but teaching, was that we Jews are going to stick around, but we're not going to have it easy. So put that aside. They've suffered enough. It's 1947, not 1937. 6 million were killed. Genug. It's enough. And then 10, avoid speaking of the Jews as if the first members of the church had not been Jews. So, you know, ethnic jokes, stereotyping. People tell all sorts of, you know, humorous comments at some other ethnic group's expense. And whether it's good-natured, or it's really nasty and said with venom, whatever it might be, it was probably fun to disparage the Jews, mock the Jews, get a good jolly at the expense of the Jews. But remember, the first Christians were Jews. And if you think about that, maybe you'll hold back from the worst of the comedy show at the expense of Am Yisrael. So these are the 10 points. Look at in some of the chat. Doesn't the Rambam acknowledge that Sanhedrin convicted Yeshu was then turned over to the Romans executed? So the question of what actually happened to Jesus and whether the Jews were involved, there's a lot of different points of view on that. Yes, there is a view in the Rishonim that the Sanhedrin did convict him and that his death was carried out by the Goyim because the Jews didn't have the capacity to carry it out. But the better scholarship is that there was no trial by a Sanhedrin. There was no trial even by a Kohen Gadol. If Caiaphas had any involvement, it was simply to express his viewpoint that this guy's bad, and we'd be happy if he was bumped off. But that the crime was that he's so-called king of the Jews, which is a political rebellion, not a theological crime. The Romans couldn't care less. And if there's one line in Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion, and I saw it the first night it came out on 84th Street Lowe's in West Side. There were people picketing the movie theater. But I wanted to go in and see it because I wasn't going to picket something unless I knew really what it was. So the first night I saw it, and it's really a 2-hour slugfest of just smacking him till he's dead. But if there's one line in the whole movie that stands out, it's when the Jews turn to Pilate, and they say to him, "You know, we want him killed." And Pilate says, "What's his crime?" "He violated the Sabbath." And Pilate says, "Who cares?" And then he's ultimately killed for something else, for a political rebellion. But the idea is that the Romans didn't have any particular interest in coercing ritual observance or, you know, halachot of Judaism and theology of Judaism, because that was an internal Jewish affair. They only care for the maintaining of their sovereignty, their hegemony over the country. And so to the extent they're going to kill anybody, it's someone who threatens that control over the country. So, all right, we'll stop here. Next week, we're going to discuss the separation, the parting of the ways between the church and the Jews, and how that led to ill will on both sides. We'll discuss the persecution of the Christians by the Romans, and to the extent which the Jews were involved in that persecution, which might lead to further ill will against the Jews. And we'll try to make our way probably as far as Constantine's conversion of the empire to Christianity. Okay, have a good night, everybody.